You should be here for a Clearman Internet seminar called Negotiations Training for OSCs. This is Module 4 in a 4-part seminar series that has been sponsored here on the Clean Up Information Network by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Jean Bell. I come out of that same office, and I'll be helping to moderate today's session. Everyone should have a copy of the materials in front of them today. As with all Clearman seminars, it's all individual participants who must manually move themselves through the materials and verbal cues from the instructors. So you should have, if you haven't done so already, either downloaded a copy of the PowerPoint or PDF version of the slides, or you should be looking at them through a web browser window, and you should be on the first slide, which is the title slide for today's session. A reminder to those of you who are joining us on the phone lines, you want to be sure to keep your phones on mute. You can use your own mute button or simply hit *6 to mute your line. There will be a number of points throughout the session where you'll be asked to interact and engage and ask for questions from the instructors. So you are, of course, at any point in time welcome to take yourself off of mute to do that, but until then, while they're talking, we prefer to minimize background disruptions and just keep your phone on mute, and also don't put the call on hold. You can always hang up and call back in. There's no enter or exit tone, so you won't be disrupting the call at all by doing that. Just go ahead and hang up if you have to put it on hold, and then call back in. Again, if you haven't accessed the slides, you can do so by either visiting the email confirmation message you received from me or the reminder one you would have received today and following the link to the seminar homepage. Or again, you can either look at the slides online or you can download a copy of those slides. On that seminar homepage, you'll also find contact information for myself as well as the instructors. So if you have any other comments or questions you need to follow up with us, feel free to refer to that. You'll also be able to find a link to the seminar feedback form. So as part of the process for getting credit for participating in today's session, not only do you have to actually respond to roll call and then interact with the instructors and answer questions, but you also have to officially fill out the feedback form successfully with the correct secret password, which will be given out throughout today's session. So you want to be sure to refer back to that link, which we'll show you again at the end of today's seminar as well. I'm going to ask everybody to move ahead to slide number 2. I'll finish up some of those reminder messages. Again, if you are looking at the slides hard copy, again, just turn the page. If you've got the slides up on the web browser window, you can use the numbered links that appear to the left of the slides, or you can use the arrowed icons that appear at the top of your slides. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow to the left will move you backwards one slide. Another thing to be sure you want to do, again, there will be questions, and you'll be asked to interact and engage with our instructors today. So if you're looking at those slides through the web browser window, there's a question mark button that appears at the top. As long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, you will be able to click that question mark button and have a new window pop up where you can type in a message, answer questions, reporting technical problems you may be having, and also respond to the roll call when I do that. If you can't get that to work, you can certainly email me at any point in time, and we'll use that to interact with you as well. And the final reminder that I have for everybody today is that this module is being recorded. And again, as part of the seminar series, there are 4 modules. You have to take all 4. You can do up to 2 of them archived. So as soon as we finish the last delivery of the 4th module, which is going to happen on October 20th, we'll send an email message to everyone who participated with the links to access all 4 of the recorded sessions. You can go ahead and listen to that. But just a note, if you do have to drop off today's call or you have a colleague that you know needs to take it, they will be able to listen to a recorded session. Again, up to 2 of the 4 can be done that way. So I think those are the end of the reminders that I have for everyone today. So again, I'm just going to ask that everybody please place your phone on mute. I do hear some background noise and 1 or 2 heavy breathers out there. So again, *6 or simply hit your own local mute button. With that, I'm going to officially turn things over to our instructors today who are coming out of the EPA's Office of Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center, and I'll ask that you all move along to slide number 3. And
hello.
Actually, take that back. Wait, one more. I apologize. I forgot roll call. Believe me, got ahead of myself. So, yes, as I mentioned, last thing, then I'll turn things over to the instructors on slide 3. I have to do a very quick roll call to make sure we have all of our participants today. I'm going to start with the individuals who registered to participate by phone, and there's only 3 names on this list. So I'm going to call your name out, and if you hear me call your name, please take yourself off of mute and let me know that you're there. So I'm looking for Kathy Young from Boston. And I understand you may be streaming the audio, and if so, you can type up a message to me that way. Brent England from Boston.
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, great. Thanks, Brent. And Calvin Parada.
I'm here.
Excellent. Is there anybody else on the phone lines that did not hear me call out their name? Everyone? All right, I'm going to assume that's the end of my phone participants. Let me just run through the streaming simulcast participants quickly. I do understand you can't verbally respond to me, but you can use that question mark icon to report or type up a message and let me know. If you're sharing the line with multiple participants, please let me know who's sitting there with you in the room. So if you hear me call your name, please type up a message and let me know you're there. Karen from Boston, Susan Fisher from Kansas City, Michael Sibley from Seattle, Joyce Ackerman from Denver, Alex Sharon from Boston, Richard Hayworth from Boston, Elise from Boston, Wayne from Boston, Marcus from Boston, Alan from Boston, John from San Francisco, Akil from Edison, Andy from Seattle, and Margaret from Edison, Gary from Boston, Tom from Boston, and of course Terry, I know you're already online, coming from California. So I will go ahead and now turn things back over to the instructors again, starting on slide number 3.
All right. Hello, everybody, yet again. This is Margaret Ross. One more time. Welcome to the home stretch. I am trying to think of something new and interesting about myself to tell you now that I've introduced myself to you 4 times, but I can't. So I'm Margaret Ross. I'm with the Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center, and I want to check and see, Dan Dozier, have you made it on the phone?
I am on the phone. Can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Well, I'm Dan Dozier. I work as an environmental mediator. I've done hazardous waste disputes largely for the last 25 years, and I'm the chump.
Welcome, chump. Now, Deb Dalton.
Hey, Deb Dalton's on the line, too, and I'm playing the other half of the Tom and Ray chump part today.
Great. And lest we forget, our important reality checker extraordinaire, Terry Brubaker.
Well, it's Terry Brubaker, former removal manager in Region 9, and all I'm going to say is go Giants.
Go Giants.
As long as it's not the Yankees, Terry.
All right.
But what about the Packers, guys?
All right. That's a different...
Different sport.
Go Packers. I'm much more of a Packer fan than the Redskins.
All right, guys, before we need a mediator on the call, let's move on to slide 4. You guys know this stuff, course credit, course evaluation. We care. We use them. Please do them. Thank you. Thank you. Slide 5 or slide 3, depending on what you're looking at, negotiations course learning objectives. So, here we are in the home stretch. We've covered a few of these learning objectives already. Today, we're going to be talking about 3 kinds of things. We're going to be talking about a 5th bonus obstacle for you guys. You thought you were only going to get 4, but we are going to give you 5. You're going to be so outfitted to handle anything that comes your way. So today we're going to talk about skills related to power and obstacles related to power in negotiations. We're going to talk about when it makes sense to get a mediator. And, of course, most importantly, at the top of the heap, we are hoping that at the end of today's module, you will have a better ability to recognize how you can apply the stuff that we've been talking about in the kinds of situations that you're going to find yourself in every day, both on and off the job. But hopefully, by going through some of these cases, you'll get a better sense of how you can apply the kinds of tools we've been talking about in the last 4 modules to situations that you're going to face in your job. Next slide. We just kind of talked about this, so let's move on again to slide 7. When we're going through this, we're going to follow a similar pattern to what we've done in the past. We're going to talk about what this is, what power is, how it can impact negotiations, and what you can do to overcome obstacles. And then at the very end, I'm hoping that we'll have a little bit of time to go over some extra resources and key takeaways just a little tiny bit of a summary and point you in the direction of materials that we've uploaded to the resources page and let you know what those are. All right, let's dive in. Moving on to the next slide. It should be title slide that says obstacle number 5, their power. And the quote is, use power to bring them to their senses, not to their knees. And that's directly from Getting Past No from William Urey. Now, power is a huge topic. Power dynamics are ubiquitous, and the use of power to get what we want is ubiquitous. It's everywhere all the time. Before we get into the kinds of obstacles that power can create and what you can do to overcome those obstacles, I just want to take a quick minute to talk about what power is and different kinds of power that you might see in negotiations. So I'm just going to name these off and say a little bit about them. The first kind of power that I'm going to mention is formal authority, and this is the kind of power that you get when you are in a formal position that gives you decision-making authority, right? So you're in an organization or there's some kind of structure that endows you with the ability to make decisions for other people. The next kind of power is kind of an expert information power, and this is the kind of power that you have when others perceive you as an expert in a particular area of expertise, right? So you've got a PhD in underwater basket weaving, and everybody knows that you are the go-to person. They may not understand everything you have to say about underwater basket weaving, but they believe that you are the foremost expert. The next kind of power is the power of association. This is the power that you get from having powerful friends. So maybe you're not in a powerful situation, but maybe you know somebody who might be willing to come to your aid. That gives you a certain kind of power. Fourth kind of power is the power of resources. This is a kind of power that allows you to either control the resources that will affect decisions being made, or maybe the processes by which decisions are made. Fifth kind of power is nuisance power, and we've got a great case about this today. This is just the ability to cause discomfort to your opponent, to annoy the heck out of them. It's a real source of power, and it does need to be dealt with. And then finally, the power of sanctions. This is the ability to inflict pain on your opponent. This is the ability to have some kind of negative impact on your opponent that they don't want to have happen to them. And all OSCs should know that they have this power. They have the power of the law behind them, and you guys have the power to create sanctions where they're required. So with that, let us dive in to the next slide, and we're going to talk about how power can negatively impact negotiations. So first, you know, it should be pretty clear that any kind of power can be used positively or negatively for the powers of good or for the powers of evil. You know, you can harness the power of fire to create warmth or to burn houses down. And so we need to think about that when we're thinking about any kind of power. But we want to talk about these kind of three negative influences on negotiations first. So first and most importantly, every participant in an interest-based negotiation has the option not to agree. That's part of the point of interest-based negotiations, right? The power is both positive and negative in that you can use it to make sure that all interests are being met. You can withhold your agreement in order to make sure that all interests are being met. Or you can use it as a tactic to stonewall, right? You can say you're not going to agree until you get everything that you want. The next one is the power of politics. This is something else that's, you know, inherently positive and negative. When used negatively, we're talking about people that use others, like third parties or hierarchies, that may not be represented at the negotiating table to actually undermine the negotiation in some way. We've got a couple of good examples, actually, in the cases today that talk about the power of politics. But, you know, I think here about kind of the car salesman who needs to check with his boss before he can give you some great deal. You're essentially building allies or using third parties in a way that undermines negotiations instead of supporting them. And you can also use the power of politics to support negotiations. The final one here is the power to corner, and this just refers to any situation where you can effectively remove any choices from your opponent, except for what you want them to do. So this might seem great, right? You're getting them to do what you want to do, and sometimes you do need to remove some of these options to protect human health and the environment. We're not going to say that that doesn't happen. But there are situations where it can backfire. So think about the situation, like a hostage situation, where there's an extreme situation, and under no circumstances do you want that hostage taker to feel like they've got nothing left to lose. You don't want your opponent to feel like they've got nothing left to lose. People, like I think all animals, are willing to take pretty drastic measures to escape a situation where they feel trapped, and they might do something pretty crazy if they really don't see any kind of hope for a solution that's going to benefit them at all. So you want to think about how you can avoid that, and we're going to talk about how you can work on bringing people away from the edge if they get there and keeping them away from the edge if they are there, or if they're not there yet. All right, so let's move on to the next slide and talk about how we overcome the negative uses of power. Basically, those are some of the negative uses of power, and what you're going to do if those kinds of things are happening in negotiation is you are going to use your own sources of power. You're going to use your power to bring people to their senses and not to bring them to their knees. You're going to use your power to support the negotiation as opposed to punishing people for being really annoying. Let's move on to the next slide. Let's talk about the power to educate. Something that William Murray mentioned in Getting Past No is that the harder you make it to say no, the harder you make it to say yes. And the reason is that the more you're able to force somebody to do something that you want, it means that essentially the agreement, their agreement, is equivalent to accepting defeat, right? So when you are forcing somebody else to do something, the second that they do that thing, they have admitted that you can boss them around or you can force them, and that's a kind of defeat. Most people don't like the way that feels, even if they are getting something that they want. So we're going to use education to try to just make it easier to say yes. Instead of making it harder to say no, we're going to make it easier to say yes. So we're going to remind folks that the goal here is to meet everybody's interests. We're going to bring the discussion back to interests, yours, theirs, everybody's. We're going to remind folks about the progress that's been made, where you've been able to agree. And you might remind them about the consequences of no agreement, to bring them back to the idea that we can all get what we want if we choose to negotiate in good faith, but there might be repercussions that would be unfavorable if we don't reach agreement. All right, let's move on to the next slide and talk about the power of reality. And this cartoon is really great, contributed by Deb, and the handwritten caption was essentially, this is how all plaintiffs see their cases, right? You've got a kind of buzzardy, goofy-looking, turkeyish kind of animal, and he looks in the water and he sees himself as a swan. When you're using reality testing questions, what you're trying to do is you're trying to call on a negotiation to think through for themselves what the likely consequences might be of their actions, right? So you're asking them to let reality be their teacher. Reality testing questions are, for William Beery, they kind of fall into three categories. These are kind of variations on the three. What do you think is going to happen if we don't come to agreement? What do you think I'm going to do? What will you do? And another really good one is, how do you see this working out? And that may be kind of on a tactical level. So, you know that somebody's got to take something to their board before any decision can be approved. And they have come up with a very strange position. And you can just ask them, how do you see that working with your board? How do you think they're going to respond to that? You know, now so-and-so's on your board. How do you think that person might respond to it? So, again, letting reality, or at least their version of reality, be their teacher. Move on to the next slide. And we can, on this slide, recognize that sometimes even reality testing questions are not going to be able to convince the turkey, buzzard, goose animal that he's actually a turkey, buzzard, goose animal and not a swan. So let's talk about the next tool, which is, for dealing with power, which is the power of Plan B. So let's take a little trip down memory lane all the way back to Module 1. I know it's so long ago, but we had Kenny Rogers in the studio. He made a surprise visit to give us some of his guru advice, and he told us that we got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them and know when to walk away and know when to run. And we talked about the kinds of questions that you should ask yourself to know whether negotiation is your best strategy. And it's these same questions that can help you define your Plan B and possibly your Plans C and D as well. Your Plan B, the thing that you're trying to formulate here, is your best alternative to a negotiated agreement. If you can't reach a negotiated agreement, what's the next best thing you can do to meet your interests? This is also known as the BATNA, right? Best alternative to negotiated agreement. So you'll hear us talk about BATNAs a lot, and that's where the word comes from. If you can't get a negotiated agreement, what's your next best option for moving forward to meet your interests? So, next slide. This is the power of Plan B continued. Your BATNA endows you with a few powers. A strong BATNA will help you warn folks. And these are listed in order of severity, from warning to actually walking away from negotiations and doing your Plan B. So there are a few steps kind of in between, right? So the first thing is you can warn folks about what your BATNA is. This is just letting them know what's going to happen if negotiations fail. These are threats, right? It's not, I'm going to do this to you if you don't do what I tell you. It's a kind of more objective statement, and this is a lot about intent when you're saying it. This is just a statement about what will happen, right? The next is actually starting to take steps, engaging some way in your Plan B to demonstrate that you are serious. So you might actually get a warrant, but still hope against hope, that somebody is going to see reason and come back to the table, because a negotiated agreement is still going to be better than the other options. So that's the power to demonstrate kind of that you're serious about your Plan B, even though you'd rather not take it. And, of course, the final power that you have is to leave negotiations and use your BATNA, right? And the points that we want to make here are that you use the minimum amount of power necessary to get what you need, right? You're not seeking revenge. We're not seeking to punish people. We're just seeking to meet our needs. And always use legitimate means, of course, right? So I don't think that we have to worry about this with any of you guys, but, you know, we're not going out breaking kneecaps, even if we might have the right connections. We're not going to do anything that is going to harm us or harm our organization or harm our reputation. All right. Let's move on to the next slide. So let's talk about some examples of what a less provocative BATNA might be. So what are some ways of getting what you need without humiliating while still allowing people to save face, that kind of thing. So one of these is using third parties to stop attacks. And this just refers to the idea that when somebody or maybe many somebodies are watching a situation, people involved are less likely to act like complete idiots or be rash or violent or whatever it is because, well, you know, people don't like to look like idiots in front of other people, or they don't want to, you know, show that they are the bully that they may be deep down inside. We don't like to look dumb in front of our friends, essentially. So if you get enough people watching, maybe you can keep people from behaving in a way that is completely rash. The second thing is building coalitions of allies to support your message. And this is what the quote here is about. The quote says, if one person tells you that you have a tail, you might laugh. If three people tell you that you have a tail, you might turn around and look. So the idea here is that you're using a coalition to do some reality testing. There's a group of sensible people who are saying the same thing. They're more likely to be believed than if it's just you saying something. And finally, you can use a third party, like a boss or a politician or a trusted advisor. This is going back to the power of politics, to bring people back to the table and support the negotiation, right? You can get somebody outside who has some kind of influence over them to encourage them to continue in the negotiation, to encourage them to see reason, etc. Of course, you can also bring a third party in to actually facilitate or mediate negotiations, and that is a totally viable source of power as well, if you have the ability to do that. All right, let's talk about the power of choice on the next slide. So, how do I overcome the negative uses of power by using the power of choice? So, let's just do a little refresh here. I would say that the best defense against being cornered is having a good plan B, having a very strong and maintaining a strong DATNA, so that you're going to have options if negotiations don't work out. So you can't be cornered. If you have a good plan B, you can't be cornered. But if you're in a negotiation where one of the parties, one of the other parties in the negotiation is starting to look or feel or act as though they're being cornered, and we also have a pretty good example of this coming up, then you should start thinking about what you can do to help them move away from the edge. You're going to go back to what we talked about in Module 3. You're going to help build your opponent a golden bridge to retreat across, right? You're going to help them see that they have a stake in the negotiation, that there is something for them that they can do that will help them save face, that will help them look as though they are keeping their honor intact. So going back to the hostage situation, we've kind of touched on this a couple times as we've gone through these modules. In the back of the Getting Past No book, there's a story about a 1982 hostage negotiation. And in the story, the hostage negotiator does everything in his power to make sure that the hostage taker feels like there's something to be gained from negotiation. The most dangerous thing in this situation is that the negotiator, that the hostage taker will feel like he's got nothing left to lose. So the negotiator uses active listening and open-ended questions to understand what this guy's interests are. He looks for ways to build trust through accruing small agreements, getting blankets, getting coffee for the guy, getting meals in the door to him and his hostages. He also looks for ways to meet the hostage taker's interests without agreeing to his positions. So, for example, the hostage taker's position is, I'm not going back to prison. I will not go back to prison. The hostage negotiator was able to get him to talk about what his interests were, what was going on behind that statement. And he was able to find out that this guy was just wanted to escape the corruption and abuse that he was experiencing in his state's prison system. So the negotiator was able to help him meet his needs by, one, allowing him to present his case on radio and TV and triggering kind of more investigations of his state's prison system, and two, by working out a transfer to federal prison, which wasn't such a hard thing to do given that he had just committed several federal offenses. But at any rate, he was able to get him out of the state prison system that he wanted to get away from. And in the meantime, the negotiator never lied about what he was what he was able to do and what he wasn't able to do. Clearly, you know, the hostage negotiator isn't going to be able to say, yes, of course, I can get you out of prison. Because both he and the hostage taker know that that's not a possibility. And sometimes there are real parameters within which you have to work. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we look at some of these cases, because there are rules, there are laws that we have to meet. And so sometimes in negotiations, being realistic is a point on your side, because you know and other folks know that you can't kind of break these laws in order to do things. But if you can find ways of meeting interests within those parameters... Uh-oh, I think we may have been put on hold here. We'll see. Then you can find a way to work things out. You can find a way to work things out that, I'm sorry, it's knocking me off. You can find a way to work things out that will both meet your legal interests and your negotiation interests.
I'm going to go ahead and globally mute everybody, so I apologize for the interruption. Again, there's going to be a voiceover that will tell me I'm globally muted, and then the instructors will need to hit pound 6 to continue talking, so bear with me.
The leader has muted your line.
All right.
All right, you're back. Great, thank you.
Great. So that was the end of our discussion about power, what it is, how it can affect negotiations, and how you can use some strategies of your own to overcome power dynamics and power obstacles. We're now going to move into the next section here, and this is our Stump the Chump section. You guys sent in some fantastic cases. We picked a few that kind of illustrate some of the principles that we've been talking about, and we are going to now get into it with Dan and Deb. I'm going to go ahead and ask Dan and Deb to make sure that they've hit pound 6 so they are unmuted and are able to talk. And then I will go to what is slide 18 on the Adobe Acrobat or online presentations. And for those of you who are looking at the PowerPoint slides alone, it is slide 16. So with that, let us introduce you and help you get to know Dan Dozier. Dan is an internationally recognized pioneer of conflict management and collaborative decision making. He's got a long history of experience as a negotiator, attorney, mediator, and he has done many, 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 perhaps more than anyone else, Superfund mediations. So we're glad to have him here. Thank you for joining us, Dan.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Good.
You were with us. All right. So, Dan and Deb, I will hand this over to you.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everybody. Essentially, what Margaret meant when she introduced me with all of that experience is that I'm old, and I've been around the block a few times on this. And the one thing I want to emphasize, because my guess is that some of this is feeling, especially to those of you who are working as on-scene coordinators and have been around the block a few times, it may sound a little theoretical or goody-two-shoes. Because I think, in fact, there's a lot of uses of power, especially the power to coerce. That's sort of essential and inherent in the concept of Superfund. But that power and how you use that power, and I would suggest to you that slide 14, the how you overcome the negative uses of power, is really important. It isn't that you don't have power and that you don't use it. It's how you use it. that I think is so really important. And I see parties in almost every single case of any kind, parties are trying to narrow the choices, or at least by educating and sometimes by taking other actions of the other party to lead them towards the result that the party wants them to. And that's inherent in the negotiations process. It's not all, you know, let's sit down and sort of the public television version of negotiation. It's real power, and it's real interests, and it's real sometimes pretty intense. But that doesn't mean that these techniques are not worth paying close attention to and using, because it's really how you do it that makes all the difference between forcing someone and having that person perceive in an unfortunate way that they're being forced, as opposed to educating them as to the fact that they don't have a lot of options and they might as well take the one that makes most sense. So I just want to suggest to you, it's not lack of power here. All of these negotiations, and I'm going to tell the joke that I told Deb and Margaret yesterday or the day before about, you know, Hillary Clinton, the great negotiator, announcing to the assembled press corps that she has found a way to bring the lion and the lamb together. And indeed, she displays on the stage behind her, pulls a sheet off the cage, and indeed in the cage there are the lion and lamb sitting peacefully together. And there's great cheer and applause, and it dies down, and at the end of the presentation there's a question from the back of the room, and Mrs. Clinton, are there any problems in this? And the secretary answers, well, there's one small problem. Every morning we have to replace the lamb. So there is an aspect of power in this that you all need to be aware of and use appropriately and with judgment and sensitivity, understanding human emotions. Deb, do you have anything to add to this?
Nope, I don't. I would say we're going to go, we have 10 cases ahead of us. If any of the OSCs that are on the line or on the computers recognize your case, or if the case looks like one of yours anyway, even though you didn't send it in, and you want to make some comments online, just type them in. Margaret's manning the internet today, and will read those to us. Let us know whether you want to use your name against it. We did take the names off of these to protect both innocent and
not so
sensitive. Sorry. So we'll go off to case number one. We have a recalcitrant RP who won't clean up. Dan, you want to take this?
Well, this is the rope-a-dope guy, okay? I don't know if you are old, any of you are old enough to remember Muhammad Ali and some of his boxing, especially in his later years. He would sit there and sort of take punishment and say, rope-a-dope, you know, and then in the end reach in and demolish somebody at the end of the fight. This is a responsible party who would agree, you know, sit there and smile and nod at you all and agree to do something and then not do it, fail to meet the deadlines, okay? He's basically a con guy. It's a very effective technique. Yeah, I'll do it, agree, and then not do it, okay? The problem was that he got away with it. He kept getting, you know, EPA kept sort of accepting the promises. The deadline would be missed, and then no consequences were attached to his behavior. Okay, and he kept blowing off the fact that there might be a real problem here. Oh, you know, my neighbors aren't going to be hurt. No, there's no problems. Everything's fine. And think about all the jobs that are going to be lost. That kind of, I'm sure you all have heard this a million times probably. So, essentially, this is the kind of a situation where the lessons to learn here are pretty simple. And that is, you know, again, without threatening and without attaching emotional intent to it and without being personal about it, you have to give the guy a dose of reality. You have to, at some point, the agency, having faced with promises that are unkept, needs to actively move and use the power, you know, use the force, Luke. And I think the lesson here is that you can't allow somebody to con you. You can't allow somebody to go forward, yes, and agree with everything and not perform.
Dan.
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
What do you do about this management that gave him 7 choices? I'm playing the the comping. 7 times. You know, the OSC's probably ready to strangle this guy way before 7 times.
Well, yes, and the point here is your problem is not with the guy. You know what you need to do with the guy. You know you need to slap an order on him. Your problem is with the management. And so guess what? Where do the negotiations go? They go back to the management. They don't, you know, okay, you've got to point out to your management what's going on here and ask them, well, do you want the site cleaned up or not? Because, you know, the guy keeps promising and then not delivering. So, as I am sure you are all aware, you all work in a bureaucracy, you all know that sometimes the more difficult, both for you emotionally, because it involves your career and your life, and so because of that, the negotiations inside are sometimes more difficult than the negotiations across the table. That's true in a lot of situations. And so the lesson from this scenario is turn inside. Look at what you have to do with your own leadership.
Right. So some of the things that we could think about here are really making it clear to this guy what our BATNA is and being able to get the management to actually support our BATNA. You know,
that's right.
The BATNA is either make you do this or we're just going to take it away and we're going to do it ourselves, and that means, you know, you'll have to pay us back. And if we give you a unilateral order, you may have to pay us 3 times back. That clearly might not, since he's trying the con job, might not get through. And your managers, one of the issues with your managers are reserving the fund. If they have any idea that, this guy would do it, you know, they got other sites to spend money on. So how do you convince your management that, you know, this is just not happening? This guy's not happening.
Well, and so one of the things.
BATNA is all around.
Right. One of the things you can do there, by the way, especially in a viable entity, and you will know by that time, probably at least to some degree, how viable this entity is. And if it's a viable entity and you're issuing an order, yeah, you're going to have to spend some money now, but you're going to get it back.
Right.
And so, again, that's part of the negotiations you have with management.
Right. Terry, you got some input here?
I think Terry's muted. Terry?
All right.
Forgot
well, while he's figured.
Are you back, Terry?
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay.
No, I think you guys have covered it. I mean, we don't know why management rolled over and, you know.
Well, sometimes you just, you know, the press of life and everything, and you hear a promise and you keep on, okay, click that box and go on to the next one. That's where the OSC's got to be the nudge.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Next
Why don't
one.
We move on? Next slide, case 2, folks. Moving on to slide. Actually, you see some pictures that were contributed by our OSC of this facility. You see it's fallen down. The next slide, slide 21, is how close are those houses anyway? Pretty close for blowing around stuff.
Yep.
So we appreciate entertaining
like
pictures
hometown,
on these. We won't even go there, Dan.
Yes,
Detroit. Okay, case number 2, slide 22. The state project manager is dissatisfied with a removal action. So we have the OSC, the state project manager. The situation, removal action at a Superfund site, the state wanted to do additional work beyond the scope of EPA. The removal action contract was written by the OSC and signed by all parties prior to the action. Included the EPA portion of the work, the state to begin their portion afterwards because of their delay in the contract. So the problem, the state PM didn't agree with the cost or the strategy, even though the action had already been initiated and the contract was signed. The state PM was upset that he couldn't be left alone at the site without an OSC present because he wasn't the OSC and couldn't direct the action. So he probably felt a little bit disrespected, perhaps. The PM lost it one day with the OSC. This process isn't going anywhere. It's bogus. The operation is sham. The contractor's terrible and will never do this work for the state directly. This action is costing way too much, and no one in the state understands why it costs so much for disposal of hazardous waste. So here, Dan, we have this guy going off on you. He's part, supposed to be kind of part of your own team.
Well,
these are negotiations within our team.
That's another example where you rope-a-dope can help, essentially. It's really...
Rope-a-dope?
Yes.
What's that?
Sit there, listen to the guy, don't react, don't respond, let him vent, let him get it all out, say, uh-huh, I hear you, I appreciate your concerns, we'll think about it, we understand what you're, yes, we all want to have an effective, cost-effective removal here. You're not going to change anything. Let the guy vent. Let the guy complain. Let the guy and acknowledge, you know, that you've heard it. I mean, don't just sort of sit there. But say, I understand that you're saying that this is a difficult thing for the state. The state is concerned about costs. So are we, of course. And then talk about, you know, your common interest on to having a cost-effective removal. And allow the guy to vent, without, in this case, talk about power. Where does the power lie here? It's obvious. The power is with the agency. EPA has all the power in this situation, and essentially, unless the state is willing to escalate this beyond where this fact pattern suggests they would, there isn't much the state can do. Now, It's not helpful to say that. It's not helpful to say, well, screw you, we're gonna do this, and, you know, you can go take a ride in a long walk off a short pier. That's not helpful. But listening to the concerns, acknowledging them, and restating, maybe in a different set of words, what the EPA's view is and where your common interests are, which are to have a cost-effective removal. I mean, come on, that's motherhood. And in this kind of situation, it makes sense to refer to the common interests. Okay. What else would you do?
No, I think that's pretty good. It's a kind of a hard thing to do, though.
Yeah.
You know, putting up with that kind of stuff and figuring out how you really talk to this guy about how he can't be the OSC on site when he's not the OSC on the site. I think, you know, we're definitely dealing Module 3. We talked about the obstacle of dissatisfaction of one of the other parties and how that can be arising from the emotional part of the satisfaction triangle, and that's clearly a little piece of this here. The guy doesn't seem, he's probably feeling kind of disempowered, you know. He thought this was his site and he thought he could, you know, direct it, and now he's not there. Terry, you got something to add?
No, I think you guys have covered it. I mean, in the end, this is an education thing. And it's not uncommon. State and local people often don't understand the difference in the way the removal program operates. And now, the OSCs have a lot of authority, but they also have a lot of responsibilities in terms of contract management. And most state and local agencies don't work that way. You know, they're used to firm fixed-price contracts and that sort of thing. And so there's an education that has to occur here. And before you can make them open to education, you sort of have to let them get all their own stuff out there. And
right.
And then explain to them once you find out, you know, what you think their interests are, you show them how what you're doing is responsive to their interests.
And I want to bring in a comment from one of the listeners. One of the OSCs listening says that she had a site where the state wasn't happy with the cleanup numbers, even though they were very protective. The state used their power to refuse to delist. And you can clarify that for me.
Delist. Take it off the list. Yeah.
They basically are saying that the cleanup didn't meet the state goals.
Right. So leaving the PRP and innocent property owners in the lurch.
That's right. Well, again, that's a very interesting kind of fact situation, and at that point, one of the aspects that we talked about here in power uses is creating coalitions, and at that point, the PRP's interest and EPA's interest may be the same on the cleanup levels. But if in the end the state's ARAR or the state says that their cleanup standards are X, and the ROD says, or the removal action has gotten it to Y, which is above X, the state, it seems to me, is got a card that they can play, and EPA needs to sit down with the PRP and try to work out some sort of agreement on what the cleanup levels are going to be. I don't think you can just blow that off and say, well, go ahead and do it. You might be able to. You might be able to say, well, look, according to our standards, the Superfund program is supposed to defer to states and ARARs about what the cleanup levels are to be. And so if this is not a removal, if it's a remedial action, I think that's a whole different set of negotiations you have to get into on what the cleanup levels are going to be. And you're going to have to deal. If the state can show you that it is, in fact, a broadly applicable cleanup standard and not just for this site, and if it's risk-based, they're going to have to, they have the burden, obviously, but they're going to be able to maybe move what the cleanup standard should be.
Okay. One of the things that I forgot to do to close case one was to tell folks how they came out. You should note that that case descriptions that were submitted in entirety by the OSCs are on the resources portion of this CLUIN, so you can go to them and read them in the way that the OSC gave them into us and read the results. In case one, after 7 strikes, it became a fund lead removal. During the cleanup, he became antagonistic, refused to observe the site boundaries till I had arranged with the local sheriff to arrest him for criminal trespass, and only then did he fall in line. His criminal trial is January 2011, so the guy may be getting what he bought into there.
And there's a good example of a BATNA.
Right. For the case we were just talking about, case 2, the outcome, the OSC in this one did very much what we just talked about, leaned back, gave him the guy his full attention or her full attention as the guy was ranting and raving and being critical, told him at the end that the process has already worked to treat the EPA excavated soil and the final cost to the state would be lower because the treatment actually works. And in the end, the OSC saved the state approximately $225,000 and completed it ahead of schedule. So it worked out in the end. The OSC had to suffer through the ranting and raving and keep that calm going.
And by the way, my guess is that the OSC, after that case, had a lot of credibility, both with the state guy that he listened to peacefully while he bitched, and also probably with the state program.
Right.
And so the long term, keep in mind one of the things that in context here that is always true in any set of negotiations among a finite group of people, as you know, among lawyers or among cleanup professionals or in lots of different situations, it's not just a one-off negotiation. Your reputation precedes you, and it makes a difference in the long run. This is a marathon here. You're in this in a long business, and So you have a tail associated with you on these cases, and it makes a difference over the long run. And this is a kind of example where I think it's going to redound to the OSC's and to the region or the agency local presence to their advantage.
Okay, let's move on to case three.
I just wanted to make one more. There's one more comment from the OSCs. In the example that was given, I think where the state refused to delist a site, just a procedural thing, you know, have to work with ARRs, and maybe the ARRs weren't at the table as early as they needed to be. Maybe the ARRs weren't dealt with in advance.
Right.
Yeah.
Right,
all
right, exactly.
So that preparation thing. Okay, we have to move on to case number three. How can we help confusion with the U.S. Coast Guard? Who is involved? The EPA, state, county, and the Coast Guard. An oily release from a broken pipe onto the beach caused the local folks to call EPA and ask for help. The EPA OSC called the Coast Guard to determine if they thought it was their jurisdiction or response, actually went on site, responded, started putting some booms in place, and trying to help out to do it. The Coast Guard petty officer that the OSC talked with did accept the responsibility, said it was theirs. The OSC said, what do you want us to do? We're on site. We've got some stuff going on. Do you want us to keep going? And the petty officer just kept coming back with a statement that was just, they couldn't order us to do anything, and they just didn't say whether they wanted EPA to do anything. They didn't want EPA to do anything. The more she pushed, the more the guy just read from the same script over and over. The OSC had thought that the Coast Guard and EPA could work cooperatively, even if it meant that EPA was just there to kind of track what was happening. So what do you do here when the guy doesn't really negotiate, doesn't give you a lot of...
You go up the chain.
You
go up the chain, and it's something I end up having to do in a fair number of cases to try to find somebody who will listen and with whom you can negotiate. There are lots of risks. And there are lots of sensitivities when you go up the chain, and so that you have to do it in the right way. But I think in the end you have to go over or around the chief petty officer and get somebody who can do something more than read off a script. That's one of the things that I hear from PRPs all the time in terms of dealing with EPA, and especially with the on-scene coordinators, is they need somebody who they feel they can negotiate with, and they don't just get the company line. They expect a company line in the sense of they understand the powers that EPA has, and they understand they have to clean up, but they'd like to be able to see, you know, some flexibility or some ability to negotiate. And there always is in these situations a lot more sometimes than people who are new to the job understand. A frustrating thing for certainly for the EPA in this case, and for parties in other cases, is if you just get somebody reading from the script. When you go up the chain, however, you do it with great tact, and you don't essentially say, "Well, I'm not getting anything from you. Screw you. I'm going to call your boss." You talk to the guy. I make a point, and I do this both in terms of going up the chain inside an organization, and I do it with companies as well as with the government, and I certainly do it when I'm talking to an attorney and I feel I need to talk to a client, which I'm perfectly prepared to do as a mediator, is I don't do it without Vaseline. I do it as thoughtfully as I can. I involve the attorney or the person I'm dealing with at the table. I ask them to set the meeting up sometimes. I invite them, or if it's in person, to come to the meeting. If it's on the phone, I try to have them on the phone so that I'm not trying to do anything behind their back. But you go up the chain.
So, Terry, going up the chain, how does that work when you're on site with your booms and you just keep getting this line of baloney from this petty officer?
Well, you know, this is not an uncommon thing with the Coast Guard. And some of the most frustrating things with them is the lack of continuity. You know, they rotate people in and out of positions every 2 or 3 years, and it's really tough to develop a long-term relationship. But then again, one way around that is hoping that the management has seen that problem and has done some reaching out to the Coast Guard. And if the removal manager is on good terms with the captain of the port, they can do things kind of informally, without making it a big deal and having the captain crap all over the petty officer. The guy probably just is not dealing from a position of, he's not the right person at the table. That's what it boils down to. He doesn't have
right. So we don't really have what she had here was not all the right people at the table. Not people with authority. What we really needed was some people with more in the way of formal authority, what we just talked about earlier today.
You're
not getting the answer, go a little higher up as tactfully as you can.
The interesting thing about this is when you go up the chain, when you're dealing with somebody that's got a lot of experience, often they are tougher in terms of the bottom line of what they want than maybe the guy that is reading from the script. But invariably, parties would rather have an effective negotiation with somebody who gives them a bottom line and is credible on what they can do and is willing to accommodate things like staging or scheduling or, interests that parties may have in connection with it that may not go to the bottom line interest.
That I think is hilarious, and that is that we are talking about an OSC who was trying to help, right? It's not like they were stealing jurisdiction. It wasn't like they were stepping on anybody's toes. I think it's truly hilarious that sometimes we have to negotiate how we can help other people.
Well,
she's already got boons in the water. You should be leaping for joy.
Yeah, but that's the story of modern age is everybody's in their own silo, and it's really hard for people to look outside their own silo.
We've got a few comments in from the audience. I think you ask your supervisor and end it. It's an RRT issue, and if it's not in your jurisdiction, it's not your issue, even if you want to help and keep the environment clean. I don't know why you want to engage the Coast Guard like this. If they want to own it, let them own it. As long as they can replace their resources before you demob, what's the big deal?
Well, the question is,
hopefully they're appearing with their own booms in time so that happens. But,
Yeah, and let me call the person who made that point. Let me suggest something. That's certainly the position or the statement that you might make. To the Coast Guard petty officer or to maybe even going up the chain, that's something, if you don't want us here, we'll take our booms and go home. Think about how that would play out if you did that and the oil went in and continued to flow into the water. Is that in your interest?
I think we're assuming that she's going to not take her booms out
until the Coast Guard
appears with their booms. I'm not sure we're going to take our booms and go home.
Well, that's what the threat is.
What
was the outcome? I think that eventually
the outcome here is that I'm assuming she did pull her booms and go home. She didn't say whether she waited for the Coast Guard to appear with theirs. I'm assuming that she did. That's my assumption in this particular case.
Yeah.
Let's go on to number four. Okay, number four. We've got a brownfield work railroaded by the railroad. The railroads, I've heard, are a pain in the behind to most OSCs who have ever dealt with them and to many RPMs even. So here we've got an OSC, the liaison between the removal and the brownfields program, the brownfields applicant, and the railroad. The brownfields applicant wants to purchase an inactive railroad line and convert it into rails to trails, bike trail. EPA and its contractor would perform the Phase 2 environmental assessment along the railroad line to assist the applicant with due diligence and to know the environmental liabilities. EPA and the contractor require access agreement from the railroad Now, I have heard access agreements from the railroad are a big pain in the patootie. So what's the problem? The railroad provided an access agreement that basically was pages and pages and pages long and required all sorts of silly shit.
Including
indemnification and probably 16 dozen other things that lawyers think up. And places liability for the releases on the recipient of the access agreement, not on the railroad who actually probably had the releases. What do you think here, Dan, on the railroads? You must have dealt with railroads.
Yeah, it's
one or two times.
Especially after Burlington Northern. I was at a conference last week, there was a Burlington Northern lawyer down there, and she was feeling pretty chipper, in terms of, their authority after the Supreme Court case. First thing, you have to understand the interest and what's behind the behavior here from the railroad. Their interest is very simple. They have all of these long, narrow properties, a series of tubes, as somebody once said in another context. And they really don't know, but they suspect or they fear, how much contamination they have along their series of tubes. And so, for somebody to come in and do a phase two on their property, exposes them to certainly gets their fear about what might be found. So they're very worried about having somebody discover contamination that nobody knew, they included probably, that existed along the railroads. So
and
you have.
Can I just interject
yes.
here for anybody who's not familiar with the Burlington Northern decision? It essentially means that any party that's facing a ranger liability could potentially convince folks that it, because it wasn't their intention to dispose, that they're not responsible.
Well, that one, and it also has a big piece on divisibility. And
that's
it's,
right.
It's really shaken up the Superfund bar. It's unclear exactly how far it'll go. If anybody is interested, I've got some articles. Bruce Gelber, who's the Justice Department Chief Enforcement Lawyer for you all, has written an article for the ABA last spring on what Burlington Northern means from the government's perspective, which is a fairly narrow reading of it. And I have articles from the PRP side that take a more expansive view. If anybody wants anything about that, I've got lots of stuff and I can give you information about it.
But the railroads were arrogant way, way before that.
That's right, but this certainly didn't do anything to decrease it. Let's put it that way. But from their perspective, understand, they're in a pretty difficult position. They really do have all these long, narrow pieces of property, and they really don't know what's along. And often, and I've seen it because I've mediated cases like this, the contamination isn't necessarily from them. It's from some, because they go through a lot of industrial areas, and it's some guy that's adjacent to them, maybe some guy that's even encroached on their property, is cases that I have seen. A plating facility that's contaminated groundwater, and it's contaminated their soil as well as the groundwater under. So there are lots of reasons why they have these concerns. And it's fair to recognize those and fair to understand it, and if you don't understand it, it's hard to understand their behavior. That's number one. And number two is, because of this, it's such a generic problem across the country, this is not going to be easy for you to resolve on a case-specific basis. It may be. Maybe there's something unusual. Maybe there's something that, in terms of economic development, or the railroad knows that there's no contamination, or some other circumstance that allows you to get some access for phase two. Probably not in these kinds of situations. So one of the things that I would suggest in this case is that EPA and the on-scene, this is way beyond the on-scene coordinator, this is beyond one case, that EPA take a look at trying to see what you can do on a broad basis, that is in a policy dialogue or some sort of higher level negotiations with a railroad, either that railroad or all the railroads, I don't know, for some sort of uniform access agreement, some sort of policy.
You would, you and Joyce Ackerman from Region 8 are right there in agreement, because she's saying maybe that's something that we ought to think of doing, is getting a mediator involved maybe and trying to bring these down and have some sort of boilerplate access agreement for these brownfields projects and these railroad access issues.
Maybe
we can take this up with the powers that be somehow.
Yeah, that's where you got to go on this, because you're not going to solve it on a case by case. Again, you may be lucky in one case because of the particular facts to get in, but on a generic, you know, most of them, it's going to be very difficult, and there's no way that you'll get brownfields, you know, some 501c3 to assume liability for releases, unless they just create a phony corporation to take the liability and then declare bankruptcy.
Right.
And there's no way that you'll get EPA to do that. So this is a tough case, and I think is an example of the kind of thing where EPA should think through this intelligently, take these facts on the ground, and try to decide on a more policy basis how they can approach it. And my suggestion would be, as I said, some sort of negotiation with the railroads about it.
Hey, Terry, so I imagine you ran across the railroads at some point in your career. Any tips on dealing with the railroads and their silly 10-page access agreements?
Well, I think most removal actions involving railroads, they involve train wrecks, you know. And, you know, the railroad always
real train wrecks.
Yes.
Now, they always want to get the line open again as soon as they can. They always talk about how it's costing them $1 million an hour to have the line closed. But in those cases, you've got, a clear authority to respond. You've got imminent substantial endangerment.
Right.
Your BATNA is 106 orders or, going fund lead. You've got a bigger hammer there. In a brownfield situation, presumably there's not enough risk to justify a removal action. So your BATNA is a lot weaker.
Yep.
Right.
And you really have to keep that in mind. You don't have much of a hammer over these guys. And in fact, it may be the other way around. But,
right.
Yeah, that's the point. Again, going back to the lion and the lamb, you got to look at the power here. And the power, if it's just the brownfields thing.
Oh, I hate to think of all our OSC lambs there.
We all like
the lion is Burlington Northern. Okay, let's.
But the one other thing I'd throw out is Terry's suggestion that there are times when the railroads need you is something that you might play, because if they do have crashes, they do need you. And, you can always try to develop a relationship based on that, especially if in the past you've pulled their irons out of a fire.
Right.
Then maybe you have some leverage.
Right.
That's true. And one of the things I've, found over the years is that each railroad has its own personality.
Yes, they do.
We always found Union Pacific a lot easier to work with than Southern Pacific. And a lot of that had to do with knowing their people, developing working relationships with them. Burlington Northern is probably towards the lower end of the scale in terms of cooperativeness. So
yes, that's certainly what I've heard from everybody.
Case, it's a, right?
They're very aggressive and very tough.
All right, moving on.
Okay.
Okay, I was just going to give the OSC's final words on that one. She says, if we perceive any glimmer of cooperation on the railroad's part, we will attempt to negotiate with them and attempt to identify their interest. Yay. Their interest might include, good thinking, unloading inactive or problematic property and contributing to a worthwhile project. However, the possibility of identifying more contaminated land may outweigh these with the railroad. One possibility on this particular one is that when the current railroad landowner purchased the line 30 years ago, they supposedly arranged for the previous railroad to retain all liability. Perhaps the current railroad owner will negotiate if they think the previous railroad is on the hook for that environmental liability. That's something that you can raise, one of those raising the doubts, asking them about their BATNAs and where they stand, maybe even going back and seeing what kind of of insurance and what the insurance companies for these folks might be saying. So, moving on to case number five. Case number five, we have a stalemate with the tribe on acceptable remedies. So this is in Idaho, I believe. The EPA OSC, the Shoshone Bannock Tribes, and the FMC Corporation are engaged in some back and forth on RCRA closed impoundments with elemental phosphorus waste that are being managed by the RP, which are generating unacceptable amounts of phosphine gas. Sites on tribal reservation fee land, the tribes insist on waste removal as the only acceptable remedy. FMC says the waste removal would cost $1 billion and couldn't be done safely anyway. So we've got some real trust issues between the tribe and FMC, maybe the tribe and EPA, depending on how our relationship is with them. FMC downplays the risk and isn't very forthcoming, and from the tribe's perspective, any remedy that's not removal, is a band-aid that only prolongs the longer decision. So, here we have some competing kinds of formal authorities in a way, Dan. What kind of things would you suggest here?
Well, this is a case of one of the most interesting in the whole group, in my view. And it really is a rock and a hard place. And the answer is, time. And the answer is, in my view, that, the EPA, either through a mediator or on their own, but you need to spend a lot of time with the tribe. Let's assume, just for this discussion, that the FMC view that it'll cost $1 billion and it's not really technically or safely done, is actually true. You know, and you'll know that or not, or at least likely true or not. Then it's going to be a question and a process of education and working with and climbing into the head and developing a level of trust with the tribe that can't be done overnight, which is one of the reasons I suggest the mediator might be helpful, because you can offload some of that time onto the mediator. But you still will have to spend time, EPA, the agency, the OSC, whoever is working this case, so that the tribe understands that you care about them and that you hear what they're saying and that you're not just blowing them off because you're trying to favor the rich corporation. You've got to build enough credibility and enough tribe, respect with the tribe, that they can find a way to trust you and find an honorable way of resolving this. That's, again, why I think a mediator could be useful. Maybe you could help the tribe by assisting them getting competent technical advice on whether the reality is as the company says it is. You can help them either pay for or identify at least technical services to help them with that. But in the end, I really do think that this is one where, assuming that the facts are true, that EPA needs to spend its time with the tribe, not with the company. You have to develop credibility with the tribal leaders, and that takes time. And also, another reason it takes time is, like churches and local unions and a few other, and citizens organizations, tribes are political entities. And it requires leadership, not hierarchical direction, for people in the tribe. So you've got to convince not just the, you know, whoever it is that's across the table from you, the tribe's consultant or the tribal chairman or whoever it is, or their lawyer or whoever it is that's representing you, but you've got to be able to convince a broader circle of people, not all of the tribal members, obviously, but you've got to convince a broad circle of people. Tribes are composed of people, and people can be rational. People will understand reality, especially if it's, you know, over time and presented by somebody who they trust and done in a thoughtful and careful way. So
If you're gonna do that, Dan, how do you keep FMC from worrying that you're just gonna go sit in the tribe's pocket?
You tell FMC, that, you know, it's in their interest for this to happen. Do they want to be in litigation with maybe you and certainly with the tribe, and do they want to get into a big fight with the tribe, to just cool it? And especially that's true, and you can't go back to the FMC and say, yeah, we agree with you. You know, we understand that it's going to cost $1 billion and we're not going to do it. But you certainly can say to FMC, as you will be saying to the tribe, the same thing, which is we're trying to deal with reality here. We want to understand the dimensions of the problems, and cost is one of the factors, but not the only one. And so we're going to spend some time exploring with the tribe on what these options are. And we will keep you, FMC, informed. But this is an issue that, you know, you're a company here, you have, but these people have to live with it. And
okay,
you have to understand that.
So what you're saying is you're going to use the power of, just to use some of the stuff we've been talking about in Module 4, Module 3 is using the power of education with the tribe, either our educating them or providing some education to see whether it gives them that golden bridge to back off and see whether there are other possibilities besides picking this stuff up and moving it.
Yes.
The other thing that I think you're saying and maybe is to define the tribe's position as aspirational. We know you'd like your land back clean without having to worry about this into the future. And let's try to talk about how we can, you know, come to a realistic, you know, best decision here.
Yes.
You notice that I went to the and statement rather than the but statement. So that's another learning we have here. So how would you use a mediator here?
Yeah, I do think a mediator here can be helpful. Again, because it's going to be a long process, and a mediator might be able to help you get in and have productive discussions among a wider group within the tribe. The other piece is the aspirational, and I want to emphasize that. It's important to acknowledge the tribe or anybody who lives next to this pile, you know. That's not an unreasonable concern that they have, and it's not an unreasonable desire to try to get rid of it. Let's see how much we can do. Let's talk. You know, we can't move the moon. We only have some sorts of power, and it's got to be within a lot of constraints that we have. But we understand that's not an unreasonable concern. So
okay.
I think that's what you do.
Any thoughts, Terry?
Just a couple. You know, one is that since this was presumably set up originally under a RCRA closure, it sounds like there may have been some flaws in that, because obviously the RCRA closure wasn't completely successful.
Yes.
That may mean that there's some trust issues. If EPA was in charge of that, or whoever was running the RCRA program for that facility, there may be some trust issues here that underlie the tribe's concerns. You know, they see it went bad before under EPA's watch, or presumably EPA had some oversight responsibility there. So you may have to get into that and find out what were the circumstances. The other is, and this is true of any site where the removal action is less than what some parties want, is you can always help build the golden bridge by agreeing to put it into the PASIQ, see if it ranks, let them know there's a process out there for dealing with this in the long term. Since it's an open-ended process in a way, I mean, it can go on for a long time. But in the short term, it's reasonable to do this removal action to take care of the immediate risk and let the tribe know that, you know, their long-term aspirations can be accommodated by the program, perhaps.
Perhaps, right.
One other piece I'd like to add that Terry, I think, is really true, especially if there's a history. Especially with dealing with tribes, there is a history, even in the case where there's no history on this particular matter in this site, and that is there's the history of our country and the relationship that we've had with Native Americans over the last 400 years. And that history also has to be acknowledged and addressed in maybe directly and certainly in subtle ways. And so both the immediate history, the local history, and then the broader history, both of those factors play into these kinds of discussions.
Okay, so ending this one hasn't been resolved yet. It's ongoing. So maybe some of this discussion can be of use to the OSC on site. Moving on to number 6, having seen no comments from our audience. Great job of active listening out there, guys. Number 6, I know, we tend to be in the Pollyanna thing. We're doing the glad game. Not hearing from anybody means they're really intensely listening.
Right, absolutely.
You're right. Okay, so the community insists on local jobs with EPA's contractors on the site. So EPA, the city, out-of-town contractors, local activists, and local residents are all involved in this little squabble. EPA continuously has received complaints about large amounts of government money being spent on this contractor from out of town. The contractor has the community has a really low employment rate. Individuals in the community, or at least the activists, say that individuals in the community are trained in the work being done, but they're not being brought on by the contractor who's doing the on-site work. And so the EPA OSC just keeps getting these activists on his or her case over and over. It's become as big a squabble as just cleaning up, is whether or not the local folks are being involved in it. It's an EJ community, and you know, there's just this issue going on. So what is a poor OSC to do here?
This is an interesting one, and one where I have a slightly harder line than, at least when we talked yesterday with the contractor, than the EPA folks did. Essentially, while you have a contract that's a regional contract for a remedial action from some, removal action from some beltway bandit, the work is done by task orders. And so you can certainly exhort, you can't require legally, but you can exhort in the task order for the contractor to hire locally whenever appropriate and qualified people are available to hire. So there are some things you can do on the merits of this to flow more people into the employment queue. You can also work with the community and try to set up some sort of hiring hall kind of approach, or find some way to facilitate the flow of supposedly qualified people to the contractor. And so, all of those things, I think you need to do. So on the merits, there are some things that you can do to respond. You don't have to respond. You have to understand the difference between the community's position and their interest here. Their position is, well, we want the contract to require a local hiring. Well, that's really not. Their interest is they want local people to be hired. And there are some things that you can do to flow more people into being local people who are qualified to be hired. But beyond that, you have to work to educate the local people that, A, you can't direct the contractor on who to hire, and B, that you can't indiscriminately or improperly spend government money, that they're taxpayers too. They understand that. And so this got to be done within the confines of the federal acquisition regs and the rules that are set up.
Just getting Terry's input here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think one thing to keep in mind is that your contractor has an interest in maintaining a relationship with you.
Yes.
And you can't tell them what to do in this case, but you can certainly tell them what would make you happy.
You certainly can.
And
I think EPA and contractors are willing to jump through hoops to make EPA happy.
Yeah. I mean, they get evaluated. There's performance evaluation boards, and you can certainly say that the PEB, when it's considering the award fee, would really look favorably if they exceeded their minority hiring quotas or whatever is, you know, in the contract to encourage them to, you know, go to 8A firms or small disadvantaged businesses or whatever.
So,
right. So what if they've done that? What if they have,
well,
you know, they're
thing,
using
Debbie,
8A firm and they have a good minority representation on their full-time staff that they're bringing in from somewhere else, and the issue is these people aren't local.
Well, again, I think you can do things to encourage the flow of local people, minority or not. You have to hear it for what it is. It's not necessarily minority hiring. It's local hiring. And so, number one, you have to understand what the interest of the community is. And so you can't put it in the box of, oh, we're going to have meet some minority hiring goals, because that may not be the issue at all. However, if you do this transparently, if you work with the community, so one of the things, it's very easy for the community to say, well, we want you to hire locally and we got qualified people. It's another thing for them to come up with job, with resumes or with bodies, you know, who are qualified.
Right.
So,
okay,
so
we gotta move.
You can call them on that as well.
Right.
Okay, moving on.
Okay, this one's ongoing also, so no answers there from the OSC. Okay, case number 7. One person is taking all of my time. Many of you OSCs out there have had more than one person that's like this. This is a removal action, a residential cleanup of 50 more homes in an EJ community. Contaminants of concern were lead and PCBs in the soil, and the conflicts evolved in the restoration phase, similar to some of the stuff we had been hearing from Terry with his mercury tailings pile. The problem here is one resident that insisted that he receive a new shed when there was no cleanup action level basis for him to get a new shed. And he just pestered people over and over, wouldn't go away, tried to knock down his shed himself and blaming it on EPA. It got to the point where the OSC couldn't attend to any other site duties. What do you do with this guy?
Well, let's not spend a lot of time on this. You politely blow him away. First thing, this is where the sort of public television approach to this just doesn't work. You know, the guy got understanding, you just keep on doing your job, and you know, there's a term I would use that I won't on this, but yes, screw it. Just keep on going. Next
right.
case.
Right, and that's what the OSC did in this case. After many, many times and lots of interruptions, finally banned this person from the site.
Yep.
It wasn't pleasing to him, but it did enable the OSC to get done. So you don't have to negotiate. Take the advice. Know when to hold them and when to run away. Okay, number 8, a lowball stonewall. PRPs, PRP consultants, branch chiefs, section chiefs from both emergency response and the regional council, the site attorney, the DOJ section chief. Oh, my God, we've got more Indians, more chiefs than Indians here on this particular one. So what was the situation? This was an initial meeting to negotiate a settlement for penalties and past costs, oversight costs for a PRP cleanup at a Superfund site. PRP came in with a totally, totally lowball offer and were prepared to walk away without a settlement with no concern about whether they went to court. They were attorneys themselves and figured they, I guess, would represent themselves in this case and just try to tie us up in litigation rather than raise their offer. Most of the negotiations were at the section and branch chief levels rather than at the OSC and staff levels. So, Dan, you've been in more than one situation where PRPs come in and lowball and just sit there with their arms crossed and say, oh, just, you know.
Well, first thing, in this case, I think EPA probably, or not EPA, the government, DOJ in particular probably in this case, did it to themselves. You're talking about past costs here. My guess is, as is always the case, it's difficult for the agency to pull out its past cost documentation effectively and clearly. And so my guess is that it wasn't so much that the attorneys on the other side of the table were sitting there lowballing and not refusing to move, is that they reading between the lines, they had no reason to move at this point because they didn't see that EPA had its act together or the government had its act together. And that's pretty clear from the description here. So the first lesson in this is the first thing you do when you go in these negotiations is you prepare. Okay? The second thing is, Pierre, these folks aren't stupid and they lose these cases. Litigating is not a huge threat to the government. I mean, you know, let's face it. And so, okay, so this case is, it goes into litigation, you move on to the next one. So the threat of litigation shouldn't be a real problem here. And so what you need to do is, why is it that they're making an offer that you perceive to be low ball? On what basis are they making? So you guys aren't prepared. Let's assume that. You're in the negotiations, you don't know what the hell your numbers really are. And so you're not going to be in a very firm ground. You're on very thin ice out there on what you're saying. So first thing you do is you turn the table on them as much as you possibly can, and ask them on what basis are they making an offer? What, you know, why are they saying that they're going to pay, you know, 15% of the past costs? And
so you're asking them to educate you on where they got their number.
That's right, absolutely. And then you can promise them that, okay, look, you have a point. We understand that we need to go back and give you the basis for our numbers, and you can be sure that the next time we meet, we'll have the numbers and the basis for those numbers. So you call them on their sort of threat that, well, you guys aren't prepared, and so screw you. So if you assume that it's too late because you're in the negotiations today and you don't have the numbers or the numbers are a little loosey-goosey, you promise to, you know, come back with good numbers the next time.
So
and
you take a break. That's one of the other strategies we talked about last time is don't get involved with their stuff, but take a break and strengthen your own case, learn more about theirs, and come back next time.
And the other thing that this case might call for, especially because it started off badly, is that this might be a case for a mediator. It might be a pretty easy, actually, set of mediations, a lot of which could be done on the phone and be more efficient than spending time screwing around with what the numbers are. And let the mediator help you put your numbers together, and let the mediator help get the numbers from the other side and see how far apart you are.
Okay, Terry, you had a good point when we talked this afternoon about this case. Why are they delaying?
I'm trying to remember what my point was.
You were saying they were going to hide assets.
Well, even if they're not hiding assets, there's a real easy reason they're delaying is they got the money in their pocket. They don't want to give it up.
Right.
You know, delay favors them.
Right. But Terry had a case in which they made lowball offers, and the whole time they were lowballing, they were moving their assets away, right, Terry?
Exactly. They were squirreling away their assets. So by the time we actually got to settlement, it was just a shell of the company left. And, you know, they folded the tent and walked away.
Right. So this is one of those tricks that they could be pulling on you, which you have to figure out a way, whether there's a way to call them or discover what their trick is.
Yeah, but if they have intentionally drained the company of assets, you have some authorities and some ability to go after those assets wherever they might be, whether they're personal or in another company, especially
right.
If you have already filed a claim on them. And
right.
Obviously you have because you have past costs.
Right.
So,
but our advantage here is we don't pay our attorneys by the hour, and even though they don't think they pay theirs because they are their attorneys, there's some lost opportunity costs on their point as attorneys or as managers of real estate that we may not have. On the other hand, I've been in cases where the Department of Justice, after a few negotiations, came back to us in private and says, "You folks have to settle this. This is the worst dog of a case. I can't believe we even took it to get rid of this case." Now, I don't know if you've ever been in those.
Oh, never, never.
Come to mom meetings between DOJ and EPA on, oh my God, why did we take this nightmare? But that's, you know, that's a problematic kind of thing that forces us, you know, when the Department of Justice kind of loses their attention span on our case, and is trying to strong arm us from that other direction of power.
Well, again, that's where I think a mediator can really help, and this is one of these cases that I think it would be more efficient probably for a mediator to work this case than the parties directly.
Right. Right. Or call them on it and bury them in litigation.
Yeah. And the thing, by the way, and I just want to say to all of you, the threat from any private party almost on any circumstance, including, you know, GE or the richest company in the world, down, you know, to some property developer, the threat that, oh, litigation doesn't bother us is bullshit. Pardon my French. But it does. It, you know, I mean, it's not that they're not willing to undertake the risk. They, you know, obviously they do. However, you know, when you litigate, it costs you money. It exposes you. It exposes you to discovery, which can be consequential for a lot of reasons, and you can lose.
Right.
So
that's
lots of
reasons. That's basically using that tactic to press it into their BATNA and to actually what Margaret was talking about earlier is talk more about our BATNA.
Yes.
So in the end here, it looks like they litigated this case and it ended up costing the PRPs lots more than their lowball offer, in addition to the time they spent litigating. Boo on them. Okay. Number.
I make one other point on this one, and that is, and we haven't really addressed it, but why are we suffering from the too many cooks syndrome here? We've got all these people involved, and the more people you get involved on one side, the more chances that you're going to have a miscommunication or your strategies aren't going to line up or whatever. It goes back to Dan's point about preparation. You shouldn't need all these people.
And sure
there's something. There's something wrong on the front end of EPA and DOJ's case that required all these people to think they needed to be involved. And the case manager, whoever it might be, the ORC lawyer, really needs to address that before it gets out of hand. And obviously that didn't happen here.
That's the most cogent comment of all about this case. I could not agree more.
Right. And there's a really great cartoon for this case in the resources, so check out the resources section. Okay, number 9. We're almost done here. We got number 9. The PRPs playing politics with the mayor of a site here. The property owners, a friend of the mayor, wants to continue to allow tenants to use a storage yard which is contaminated, citing the economic benefits. The property owner has said that EPA pushes businesses off-site to cause them to close and causes unemployment. The mayor is fully supporting his friend, the PRP. So, despite the contamination and the warnings from EPA and DEP, the property owner continued to allow usage of the contaminated areas by tenants. When EPA tried to enforce, the property owner went to his buddy who went to the senators and the congressmen talking about going to that formal authority here to try to get EPA stopped or the action changed. At times the property owner got personal and alleged wrongdoing and made by the OSC and made personal attacks on the OSC. So it got very personal, very ugly here. So what do we do to help this poor OSC?
Let me say one thing. The way this one is written, it could be, and it obviously depends on you can't tell from the facts here, but the one way to read this is that essentially the mayor was never listened to and the property owner, that this is a very one-sided view of the situation based on the EPA view, you know, the OSC's view on this, and that the mayor and the property owner have no merits to their case whatsoever. It's just graft and friendship and political back scratching. And maybe that's true and maybe it's not. But the one thing I would start with here is to make sure that you understand what's going on here and listen to both the property owner and especially the mayor. You know, what's going on about the city here? Why is the mayor, is it just because of the friendship? Sometimes that's the truth. I mean, sometimes that is, but sometimes it's not. Or it's the friendship and. So understand their case is as best you can. And understand, you know, Why is it that the property owner wants, is it just because he's getting rent from these people? You know, property owners, yeah, they want the rent, but they also, they don't particularly want the liability. And so, you know, what's going on there? And if you can educate the property owner on the liability side, that may help as well. And
okay,
similarly,
some education here.
Yeah, similarly with the tenants. You can educate the tenants.
Okay, so that the tenants would then pressure the property owner. Now, the trick is you have to create that the tenants have to be more concerned about their health than they are about their pocketbooks.
Well, they have to be educated. Everybody is more concerned about their health than their pocketbook if they really perceive that the health is a serious risk.
Right.
So the question isn't whether they're more concerned about their health. The question is, do they really perceive there a risk to be there? And,
right.
And you know,
here's where the education comes in.
Right.
Again.
And that's education.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, some people, I can't see it, I can't drink it, or I can't taste it, so it doesn't exist. But in our society, that's not very common anymore.
But what about this tactic that the property owner has taken of doing personal attacks on the OSC?
Who cares?
That's pretty ugly.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sorry. The more you react to it, the more it'll happen. The less you react to it, and the more you let it roll off your back, the less effective it is, and the less it'll happen over the long run. So,
okay.
You know, unless it's something that's serious, like threats, it's very easy in negotiations. Sometimes the best response to a, you know, something, a personal attack or something, is to not respond. Now, it depends on the circumstances. You know, if they use, well, certainly violence, but
right.
even putting it aside
to,
that, if they, hey,
okay.
you know, if they talk about, well, you know, chicks can't negotiate or, you know, they start pulling racial stuff, that's a different thing, but that's usually not the case.
Okay, so, this one's still in process. The case team has used a mediator on the personal attacks kind of issues, so they must have been pretty ugly.
Yeah.
But they haven't really gotten to start the site cleanup. So one of the suggestions here might be to actually have a good conversation with the mediator about moving the substantive part of this case forward in some way, shape, or form. Okay, now we're on case number 10, the chicken lady.
My favorite one.
This is a legendary case in Region 9 where there's a removal in some backyards in Los Angeles located near the Montrose Chemical, largest producer of DDT in the world. So EPA and START were hand-augering the backyard. One of the residents comes to the OSC, has videotaped everything that the team did.
Pulled out a huge chunk of DDT.
The resident comes back and brings the OSC a chicken that she wants autopsied. He says, no way, we're doing this chicken. Terry, you want to take this one over?
Yes. Terry, or this is Dan, I'll take it over. So she brings a bag and opens it up and says, I want you to autopsy, and he looks in and it's a chicken. He says, no way. Of course, the chicken lady knew had the phone number of the division director. She called the division director, and the division director said, do the autopsy. So our poor OSC is feeling fairly alone out there. They uncover, when they're digging in the ground, they uncover these bowling ball size or chunks of white. The woman says, oh, that's DDT. The OSC says, oh, no, that can't be. It's just concrete. The woman says, well, test it, and it comes back, and it's, in fact, DDT. So she comes up the next time, and she has a bag, and he mistakenly looks in it, and it's a dead cat. And again, autopsy. No, lady, we don't need the autopsy. It's not going to add any value. It doesn't tell us anything we don't already know. She calls the division director. The division director gives in to her, says, do the autopsy. Third time this happens, this time with goldfish. Fortunately, at that point, the division director's sensibility reigned and said, well, we don't need to autopsy the goldfish. Although I'd like to see somebody do an autopsy with goldfish someday. So,
Terry, I think you had a couple of other additional comments on this one. Are you there?
Yeah, I am now.
Okay. There we go. So it extended beyond goldfish and cats and dead roosters. She also got a number of other.
At this point, she was feeling pretty empowered, and she started making demands. At one point, it got as far as the OSC being directed to provide 40-hour training so she could don protective gear, which would enable her to get up close and personal with the work going on site and let her take some more of her home movies. This was a long-term, big removal. It took a long time, and the woman was a major pain through the whole thing.
So the question is here, you know, what are the lessons here? And we have some differences. My lesson from this is I think the division director, empowering as he was to a woman who turned out to be a little crazy, to put it mildly, was doing the right thing in that he diffused and especially somebody who's got bowling ball chunks of DDT in her backyard, somebody who has a legitimate bitch. He gave in to her, and yeah, in front of the OSC or in front of the world and God and everybody, he disempowered the OSC. Understand that. But A, I think in the long term, it didn't hurt the OSC, who was a very experienced and it can sit back and drink a beer and laugh about this case now. But also, he took a potentially difficult situation, including somebody who might be in the press, again, with bowling ball sizes of chunks of DDT in her backyard, and gave her reason to have continue to have dealings with EPA on this. And so I think that was, in the end, a wise decision, even though it had some consequences inside the bureaucracy in terms of affecting the OSCs and teaching this lady to go around, go up the chain. Not such a bad thing.
Yeah, God knows we hate that kind of teaching lessons. Terry, what's your counterpoint on that one?
I'm trying to think if I ever really have a counterpoint, because I think Dan's got a good point. I was sort of caught in the middle on this one, and I was rather more sympathetic to the OSC's point of view than the division director's at that time, which didn't gain me a lot of points with the division director. In the end, I think things were resolved. I think the issue with this woman and empowering her is that it had an effect on the rest of the community, and they saw her. She became the voice of the community in many ways. And that made it much more difficult to engage the other residents in terms of access to their property and what the remediation plan was. And it complicated and delayed the whole process. In the end,
right.
It got done, though.
Have been some other ways of dealing with her emotional issues of cats and her chickens, which she might have had names to. It might not have opened up the door for her to be trotting around in protective gear and videotaping everything. But, you know, in retrospect, if people had this to sort of replay, there might have been other ways to show empathy and deal with her emotional losses and her problems without empowering her to the extent that she apparently became empowered.
But let me ask a question on that, because I have this little theory that I'd like to spin out with you about dealing with difficult people in these kinds of situations. And that is, and Terry's point is absolutely true, everybody's watching this. You know, I mean, this is being played out on a stage, and so the rest of the neighborhood is watching EPA and how they deal with this woman who has a legitimate beef in that, you know, she got DDT in her backyard, in a serious way. So I have this theory, from Mark Sandman. It's not my theory, but I think it's very accurate and very effective way of looking at it. There are basically five circles of players in this. The inner ring is the crazy people, or if not crazy in the clinical sense, certainly not, but the most involved, the most emotionally invested, the ones who are the most difficult to deal with, and who you're never going to solve, whose issues and whose concerns you're never going to resolve. They're always going to have more. They're always going to be more needy. They're never going to agree. But then you have all of the watchers. You have the next circle out of the neighbors, the immediately affected people who are watching how you deal with this person, the nutsy one. And if you deal with that person with respect, and if you deal with that person with, with some integrity, those people see it, and you get new respect from them, because they're seeing that that person is crazy too.
Okay, we're going to need to move on here because we've got 4 minutes left.
So
we're back. Chicken Lady got her protective gear and trotted around on site. The OSC, the OSC's direct supervisor, Terry Brubaker of our fame here, actually sent somebody down to take him out for a beer and cool down, and he has remained at OSC. This happened 20 years ago, so he survived and has somewhat of a sense of humor looking back at this.
Yeah, that's the one thing on all of this. You got to have a sense of humor.
Right. So we're going to move on.
Last tagline on that, Deb.
Okay.
What?
Which was that after her yard was remediated, her home was raided by the police.
There was
a prank lab there, and her husband did hard time for a cookie.
See?
Right. So some people come into what they deserve in the end, maybe. Okay, so we'll move on now to slides 33, we're going to talk really, really briefly about mediators. We've mentioned them several times in this. Slide 34 is one of our favorite cartoons here in Mediator Land, showing Hagar asking if it's too late to request a mediator. In most of our views, it's never too late. We can't necessarily give you the parachute as you fall off the edge, but we might be able to prop the edge up a little bit for a little while. So when do I bring in a third-party neutral? I think you've heard a number of times when you can bring somebody in. You have too many roles. The parties are unlikely to be candid or friendly with you. You have some difficult people. You don't have enough time to manage all the pieces. So there is a help button. Push the help button. You can call CPRC and get a mediator who can help you on slide 36. A mediator can help you figure out why things aren't working, help you take care of some procedural matters so you can focus on the substantive stuff, help you overcome some impasse or low trust. Bringing in a third-party neutral, we have specialists in each of the 10 regions. I see that Ellie Tonkin is in conference with the Region 1 folks up there. We thank her for that. There are ADR specialists in all of the other 10 regions. When you got your Getting to Yes book, you should have gotten a flyer that if you turn it over on the back, you'd see the list for people in your own region. We can help you get access to our contract for bringing in mediators and can bring them in on very short notice, usually less than a week, sometimes only in a few days, depending on your need and the availability of good folks. Slide 38 explains how you do that. So, wrap up. Margaret, you're on.
Yep, I'm here. I just wanted to thank you guys again for hanging in there with us and point out that there are some resources for you on the resources page. They include a couple of articles that might be of interest to you, some stuff on managing science and technical information in environmental cases, some stuff on building trust, and we've thrown in some other things, some tip sheets that you might want to print out if you're interested and just keep them around so you can refer to them. And I think that's it. I also wanted to recommend a book called Difficult Conversations in addition to the Getting to Yes and Getting Past No. You might want to check that out. And again, thank you guys so much. Thanks to Jean and her team for making this whole process really easy to use. And thanks to Dan and Terry for their incredible insights. And if you guys have any questions about bringing on mediators or dealing with the difficult
our password.
Case, Oh, right. I'm sorry. The password. I was going to interrupt you guys at one point and do it. The password for today is going to be CHUMP. C-H-U-M-P, CHUMP. I am sorry for waiting so long to get this to you.
Okay. CHUMP.
So if you guys have any questions at all, please, please, please feel free to give us a call. We can talk to you about any questions you might have about any of these things as they apply to any cases that you might be on. That's what we're here for. We're EPA employees, and we are here to serve you guys. So give us a call if you need us. Thanks so much, and I'll hand it back over to Jean.
Okay, great. Thanks, guys. I appreciate everybody wrapping things up on time. I was a little bit worried there for a second. But I'm going to direct everybody to move along to the very final slide in the presentation today. So if you're looking at them online, it'd be slide number 42. And on that final slide, you'll see two links. The first link is the additional resources page, where you'll find a number of the documents that they've mentioned throughout today's session, as well as the opportunity to download today's PowerPoint material if you'd like. The second link on the final slide is the all-important link for your feedback form, which you will need to successfully complete, along with today's secret password, which, if you missed it earlier, is CHUMP. And you'll have to fill out that feedback form in order with that password to get credit for participating today. I know some of you are sitting around sharing the computer, so after each step you fill out the feedback form, there'll be a link to allow the next person in the room to submit their own feedback form. So you can do that. There's also a checkmark box that I suggest you check that will send a confirmation message to you as for your own email records that verifies that you did indeed submit feedback for the session. If you're not sitting at a computer with internet access right now, that's okay. That feedback form is available linked on the homepage for today's session, so if you just use the same URL you got in the reminder emails from me, you'll find links to the seminar feedback form at the bottom of that page, and that will continue to remain active over the next few days. I just want to, again, extend my gratitude to those who have been part of putting this course together and, again, going through the great effort to try to transition this from a face-to-face class to, I think, a really great online version, and that you guys have been able to participate remotely. I also want to thank all of the OSCs who fit us into their busy schedules and remind you that if you did have problems or you weren't able to fully participate today, this same session will be re-delivered on October 20th, and that will be the final delivery of the four-part seminar series. And then hopefully on the 21st, I plan to send out an email to everybody who registered for any of these four sessions that will give you the links to each of the archived modules so you'll be able to take whatever you may have missed out. So with that, I will formally conclude today's session. I thank everybody again for their time and their efforts, and I hope you all have a great afternoon and enjoy your weekend. Thank you.